Blog Talk Radio.
Children singing, see, they eager to learn how to become the next world leaders, brave hearts, revolutionary warfare is all fair, loving war for the cause, I gotta take you off it, revolutionary warfare is all fair, loving war for the cause, I gotta take you off it, book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but masterfully notice the weakness in all them. Got a new show me if necessary. Homie, investors is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind the beauty of life. But when my mom said, again, you could be Christ, I wasn't old enough to hold my d***ing P-right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training in difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging, splitting duchess up, strap up, the armies of school, teaching smart ways to go, I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool, got me thinking out loud, sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out, revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause, I gotta take you off here, revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause, I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals I build. With dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick Hill. For fish gills the cops, the time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. A black gorilla, crib and blood and one only killer. Know my face, I be the case for the wish at the police. Look at the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. So what we fight for, my heart goes to you beautiful wife in war.
Enlisting more and talk less. Watch all and trust none, demand your respect. And be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer. And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mitch Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, I'm sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it.
TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Free the land. Brave sharing ingredients. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio. I'm your host, Boomani Shakir. Why goals are fivefold. Our first goal, to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal, to eradicate culture ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal, transferring the criminal mentality to new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal is to prepare new African prisoners for release, reduce new African recidivism. And our overall goal is transferring the whole pre-industrial slave complex, which is the prison system, into the big industry learned through educational means. By preparing brothers and sisters to return to society and return to the community and build a productive society and nation by creating institutions and programs that will suit the needs of new African people. Before I bring in our guest tonight, I'll let go of a couple of events that happened in history during this week.
Okay.
On May the 7th, 1845, Mary Mahoney was the first new African woman to complete nursing training. She was born. In 1867, new African demonstrators staged a riot to protest segregation on New Orleans streetcars. Similar demonstrations occurred in Mobile, Alabama, and other cities. In 1885, Dr. John E.W. Thompson, graduate of the Yale University Medical School, named Minister to Haiti. In 1925, the Department of Negro Literature and History, now the Schomburg Center, opened at 135th Street, branch of the New York Public Library. In 1946, William H. Hastie inaugurated the first new African governor of the Virgin Islands. On May 8, 1858, John Brown held anti-slavery convention, attended by 12 whites and 34 new Africans in Chatham, Canada. In 1915, Mary Louise Williams, pianist and songwriter, were born. Also 1915, Henry Menea Turner, the first new African chaplain of the U.S. Army, AME Bishop, died in Windsor, Ontario at the age of 82. In 1926, A. Philip Randolph organized New African Union of Railroad Porters. In 1971, FBI Director Clarence M. Kelly apologized for FBI action that were, he said, clearly wrong and quite indefensible. Reports from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and other official agencies detail a pattern of spying on American citizens. Among the events were break-ins, wiretapping, and massive surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. In 2009, members of the Ku Klux Klan burned a cross to intimidate residents of a new African neighborhood in Ozark, Alabama. On May 9, 1862, three generals organized new African regiments without the approval of the Lincoln administration. Black David Hunter began organizing the first South Carolina Volunteers. The first new African regiment on May 9th. Jim Lane started organizing the first Kansas Colored Volunteer in August, and Ben Bullitt issued a call for free new Africans on New Orleans on August 27th. Also in 1862, General David Hunter would issue a proclamation freeing the slaves of Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, rebels. Lincoln revoked the proclamation on May 19th, returning some 1 million new Africans to slavery. In 1899, John Albert Burr passed an improved rotary blade lawnmower. On May 10th, on today's date, with the 1652, a free new African man named John Johnson was granted 550 acres at Northampton County, Virginia, where imported 11 white persons. In 1775, new African patriots participated in the first aggressive action of American forces to capture Fort Ticonderoga the Burger by Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys. Also on the day in 1740, South Carolina Act, the Negro Act of 1740, which allows enslavers to whip and kill enslaved people who violated the law by growing their own land, learning to read, assembling groups, or earning money. in 1837. Pinckney B.S. Pittsburgh, the first new African to become a governor of the state, was born. In 1913, the General Harry Tubman returned to Essex. On May 11, 1865, new Africans held Massamit in Norfolk, Virginia, and demanded equal rights and ballots. Other equal rights meetings and conventions were held in Petersburg, Virginia, June the 6th, Richburg, Mississippi, June the 19th, Alexandria, Virginia, August the 3rd, Nashville, Tennessee, August the 7th through the 11th, Raleigh, North Carolina, September the 9th, Richmond, Virginia, October the 3rd, and Jackson, Mississippi, September the 10th. In 1898, Louisiana adopts a state constitution designed to purify the electorate by using poll taxes, literacy tests, and landowner requirements to block new African people from voting. 1895, William Grant led Overscrew was born. Also on this date, 1933, the Honorable Louis Farrakhan was born. May 12, 1871, CN demonstration in Louisville, Kentucky. 1910, 12 through the 14th, the second NAACP conference held in New York City created permanent national structure. In 1967, H. Rod Brown replaced Stokely Carmichael and chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And the brother still, the brother right now is currently a political prisoner at Iman Jamil Amin. May 13, 1862, Robert Smalls, a new African pilot and future congressman, sailed on Confederate steamer, the planter, out of Charles, South Carolina Harbor and presented to the U.S. Navy. He commandeered her himself. 1865, two white regiments, a new African regiment, seeing the second, USCT fought last action of war at White's Ranch, Texas. Brutal bomb. In 1985, the brutal bombing of the MOVE headquarters in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania by police. Over 257 people are left homeless in an ensuing fire that engulfed Osage Avenue, 11 MOVE members. Individual children are murdered. And the only survivor was Ramona Afro, who's still among us. In 1979, Madison Granada overthrew Eric Gregory and established the People's Revolutionary Government in Granada. You know, those events have a history during this week, but you know it's more. I'd like to first of all thank everybody who's been joining our broadcast since 2014. I thank all the people who are currently educating themselves in the community and doing the particular work. You know, I'd like to salute everyone for doing the particular work. You know, and tonight, I'm going to bring on the last poets who will commemorate. They're going to commemorate a 55th anniversary on the born day of Malcolm X, which is May 19th. And we'll return Malcolm X Day. And I have on the line with me Elder Abedun Ayoweli and Brother Sharif Simmons. Let the brand new brothers on so they can introduce themselves and we start informing the interview. I open your line. Peace, brother. Your line open.
Peace. How you doing?
I'm doing well. First of all, I thank our brothers for coming to their platform, sharing how to understand, thank you for working here the past, present, and future, right? You know, at your own leisure, y'all can introduce yourself. Tell us about who you are, what your name is, so we know exactly who we're talking to.
All right. My name is Abedun Ayoweli, and I'm one of the founding members of The Last Poets.
Sharif Simmons, and I'm one of the newer members of The Last Poets.
Okay. I appreciate that. The first question is, to give it toward the Elder Abedun. Why exactly was The Last Poets founded? And why was it founded on Malcolm X Born Day?
The Last Poets started on May 19, 1968. We were commemorating the birthday of Malcolm X in a park in Harlem called, at that time, the park was called Mount Morris Park. The park has been renamed since then. It's now called Marcus Garvey Park. But on May 19, 1968, David Nelson and a man named Guylain Cain and myself, Abiel Dune, we went on stage as a group. The idea of the Last Poets was, because we have a need for unity amongst our people, and we know poets, generally speaking, hang out solo. They don't usually join groups. They function as individuals. And we thought that by bringing some men together from different walks of life and going on stage as a group would be a prime example of how much we needed to unify. So we decided to create a collective. And we did not have a name at the beginning. It was just three men on stage as a group. We went on stage, and we actually performed our poetry, which directly connected with the folks. The poem I did was called What's Your Thing, Brother? A poem that David did was called Are You Ready, Black People? And a poem that Kane read was that he performed was called Niggas Are Untogether People. So we had established ourselves on May 19th. And because of the impact of what we had to say, we got a gig the very next week at New York University. And during that time, Kane had made a statement that we needed to have a place in Harlem so that we could endear ourselves to the people who we were trying to reach. So we found a loft space between Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue, and we named that space the East Wing. And in that space, we would have workshops, and we would actually have performances, and many of the revolutionary artists of that day would come through and perform at the East Wing. And during that same period, David Nelson, who is now known as David Nelson because he's a black Hebrew now, he started researching what would be the best name for us to call ourselves. So he read poems by Sterling Brown, Strong Men Keep On Coming. He read poems by Margaret Walker. But the poem that finally clicked was a poem written by a South African poet named Kgaphetse Kokosile. No one could say his first name too well because we're not familiar with the Zulu language, so people call him Little Willie. Little Willie Kokosile had written a poem that can be found in an anthology, a tremendous anthology called Black Fire, and it was edited by Leroy Jones and Larry Neal. Leroy Jones we know later as Amiri Baraka. In Black Fire, on page 2, I think it's page 236, I'm not sure exactly the page, but in that book, there is a poem entitled Towards a Walk in the Sun. It's a poem written by Kokosile that speaks about the conditions that Africans in South Africa had to go through under the apartheid regime. For those people who are not familiar with apartheid was a system that actually denigrated black people. They had to walk around with their IDs. And if their ID was, if they did not have an identification on them, they would be thrown in jail directly. And it was just a very horrendous situation for people who had come into their homeland and had taken over. And the folks lived under the apartheid situation for some time. So the poem talked about how horrible it was living under that particular system. And you could feel the anger of the poet in the poem, which is called Towards a Walk in the Sun. Towards the end of the poem, the poet in bold writing says, "This wind you hear is the birth of memory. When the moment hatches in time's womb, there will be no art talk. The only poem you will hear will be the spear point pivoted into the punctured marrow of the villain and the timeless native sun dancing like crazy to retrieve rhythms of desire fading into memory." David Nelson added, "Therefore, we are the last poets of the world." So we were simply saying that the poetry that we are going to present is a wake-up call to all black people to let everybody know that it's time for a change, which, of course, we refer to that change as a revolution. A lot of times people think a revolution is bloodshed, and many times it is bloodshed. But the main thing that we wanted to show was that the revolution that we need is to change the way we do things and how and who we listen to and who we look to for approval. We need to look to ourselves. We need to actually find ourselves more sacred than we have ever seen ourselves being before. And we need to stop trying to fit into a system that was never designed for us. It's like Kane had a line in one of his poems. He says, "Whitey takes a piece of wood and carves a little shoe out. We take our big feet screaming like hell all the way in." And that still continues. So we walk around with hurt feet and complain, when the fact is that we should make our own shoes, we should have a life and define ourselves for ourselves and not depend upon the system to do that or depend upon other people to do that, because when they do that, they control our lives. So the last post was a wake-up call to all people to become more conscious and to become more respectful and to become more loving within our own race and our own community.
Okay. That was real beautiful, man. That was real beautiful, you know. It's all about education for liberation, right? You know, that's a very detailed story. I understand that you got some new material out called Gratitude, you know. What did it actually mean to you right now in your age of life? What did gratitude mean to you?
What is the significance of that? Well, you know, it's very important that we show gratitude in everything we do. We need to be grateful for our existence. We need to be grateful for every day that we wake up, because nothing is promised to us. We were not brought here to live and to thrive. We were brought here to serve and to die, and we need to be clear about that. So I'm very grateful that I have been able to be here and I've been able to accomplish what I've done, what I've accomplished. And the whole album actually was a family project, and it starts out with me paying tribute to my mother and father. And we need to do that. We need to show more gratitude. Many of us take for granted a lot of things that happen in our lives. It's like we don't look back and recognize all the people who helped us be here. A lot of us don't take time out to give thanks to the people who have helped us arrive at the point where we are, to give thanks to the people who are supporting us in everything that we do. And that the album Gratitude does that. And I wanted to touch on certain issues on gratitude. For example, we have issues, many of us have issues about who we pray to. Muslims have issues with Christians, and Christians have issues with Muslims. And then you got Yorubas. For example, I practice the Yoruba religion. And people would frown on that because they don't do that. They may be Christian. And that's ridiculous. I don't care who you practice, what you believe in, but believe in some force, some higher force that can help govern your spirit and your life. And it doesn't matter what God you worship. Just believe that there is a force that you should worship and meditate towards, because we need that spiritual help. We are a spiritual people, and that's the bottom line. And when we don't enhance or try to embellish our spirits, we are in trouble, because the body and the mind cannot function without a spiritual worth. So I've tried to deal with that in gratitude. I have a piece called Praise the Lord. And understand that we need to be in harmony with nature, and we need to be in harmony with each other is what matters most. In gratitude, I also deal with the fact that we need to recognize the value of poetry. I wrote a piece called The Poem, and I just talk because through poetry we can say a lot of things that we wouldn't probably say in a conversation, even though much of the poetry that we write comes from conversation. But a poem kind of capsulizes the important aspects of our conversation to the point where it can lead us to a place where we can think better and function better and have a direction on which way we're going and where we've been. So I dealt with that. In gratitude, I have a piece that deals with just the idea of us recognizing what the struggle's all about and trying to make sure that we see our struggle is a struggle, like you said earlier, for liberation. We're trying to liberate ourselves from a system that has kept us in chains, even though the chains are not as visible as they once were, but they're still there, and we have them in our minds. And we see those chains reacting all the time when you consider the situation with the brother who was held, that was killed by five black cops, beaten to death. I mean, Therese Nichols. I mean, that was unnecessary. But that's self-hatred. And many of us are still functioning with self-hatred. Many of us, because we have learned, they have taught us how to hate ourselves. Many of us take that hate that we have for ourselves and we lash out at each other and we kill each other. We're not going to look in the mirror and smack our own face. We're not going to look in the mirror and take a gun and put it to our heads. But we'll do that to each other because we've been trained to hate ourselves when we should be loving ourselves and we should be trying to help ourselves. So gratitude touches on all that. I talk about how valuable it is for us to respect our women and how we can, no brother can do anything without a woman. We need the sisters. The sisters have always carried the brunt of the struggle. They've always been in the front lines, and they've held up the powers that we have, whatever power we have, whatever life we've had. The sisters are responsible for nurturing that life, and they've continued to do so. I mean, Harriet Tubman was a sister who cared enough about her people to go back at least 19 times back into the jaws of the whale, so to speak, to liberate her people. She even once said, I could have freed more people if they realized that they were slaves. So it's always been the sisters, and I wanted to give the respect and honor to the sisters as well. And that's a part of gratitude, showing the gratitude that we need to show to elevate our understanding of our position here on this planet, how we've come to be, and the magic that we've always had. We are a very magical people. We are a magnificent people. We have given the world a story that is still untold. People have gained millions and billions off of what we have done. And we still entertain them playing basketball and football and all the sports and entertainment and our cooking. Every skill, every gift that we have willfully and willingly shared it with others who have had no respect for us, but we still continue to show others love. We need to show that love to each other. We need to pull our cords out of their sockets and plug into each other and help each other be better people, help each other get through the struggle that we are going through right now. That's what gratitude is all about.
True indeed, man. That was about self-love, you know. That's beautiful. That's beautiful, man. I had a couple more questions. I'm going to go to Sharif, right? What exactly does your name mean, you know?
Abi Odun is a name that I was given when I was 15 years old. When you have a half a day in high school back here in New York City, I guess this happens probably all across the country, you don't, if your parents don't know you have a half a day, that's some time off. It's free time. So here I was raised in Queens, New York, and I had a half a day. I went to school in 59th Street and 10th Avenue, which is in Midtown Manhattan. The name of the school I went to was Harron High School. I actually went to school with Sylvester Stallone. He was in the same school I was in. It was an all-boys high school right across the street from Power Memorial, the school where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar went to. He was called Lew Alcindor at the time. And that day, we had a half a day. A friend of mine and I would, on half a days, taking that free time that we had, we would go one or two places, either down to the village to see all the freaks because the white folks were beatniks and they were looking weird and strange. And we'd just go in there for laughs because they were funny. And they looked funny, and we enjoyed the entertainment of looking at these funny-looking people. And then some days we go to Harlem, because Harlem has always been the citadel of black culture. So on this particular day, we came to Harlem, and we were walking through Harlem, and around 119th Street and Lenox Avenue, that's before it was renamed, because now Lenox Avenue has been renamed to Malcolm X Boulevard. But on 119th Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, there was a African-looking temple there, and I saw it, and I started clowning it because the only thing I knew about Africa was from watching movies I'd seen on TV called Tarzan. So I was saying everything that I heard in the Tarzan movies. I'm standing in front of the building, I'm saying, Ooga Booga, Bwana Bwana, and I'm just making African sounds and making these sounds. I didn't know what I was saying. I was just clowning the place because it was African. It looked like something out of a jungle, and I was clowning it. And then this light-skinned guy dressed in full African garb comes out, and he says, why don't you come inside? You might see somebody else that's entertaining. And he wasn't offended. He invited me inside. I went inside. There were African masks that had a whole different aura, and it was kind of strange to me. But I sat down. He gave me a black stone to hold in one hand. He gave me a white stone to hold in another. He said, I want you to shake and separate. So I shook the stones in my hand, and I separate them. And he said, when I point to your hand, open it up, see what stone is in it. So we went through this process. And in the process, every time he pointed to my hand and I opened up and he'd see what stone I'm holding, he'd write something down on a piece of paper. And after a while, he says, well, your name is Abi Odun Oyewole. I said, no, my name isn't Abi Odun. My name is Chuck Davis, Charles Davis. They call me Lucky Chucky. I was proud to be called, have a European name. I was not trying to be African, because African was nothing appealing. Africa was nothing that I had grown to appreciate, because that's not how I was raised. Many of us have been raised to dislike Africa, to see Africa as an uncivilized place. And I was one of those folks. I didn't know anything at all about Africa. He says, no, the name that you have now that you're using is a slave name. I said, I'm not a slave. I'm not a slave. He said, but you have a slave's name. You have the name of a white man, and you're not white. You're an African person. So he was educating me. He wrote my name down, and he wrote it down phonetically so I could say it. Abiodun. And then he wrote down what it meant. It's a name given to a child born during a festive occasion. And then he gave me my last name, Oyewole. Good fortune follows me. So my name is a name given to my first name means he who brings joy, because if a child is born during a festive occasion, that's a reason for more fun, more joy, more drinks, more food. Let's celebrate, because Sister So-and-so just had a child on this great day. And my last name, Oyewole, good fortune follows me. All of us want some good fortune to follow us. So I've been blessed with that name. I didn't use it right away because I'm unfamiliar with the language. It didn't sit right. It didn't feel right in my mouth until one day me and my friends were at a meeting uptown in Harlem, and a brother was on stage and said, and many of you Africans are sitting out there proud to be called by your slave master's name, Paul and James and Mark. And he was clowning us, and I told my boys, I said, I got no slave name. And they said, man, your name is Chuck. That's what we call white people when we talk about them coming. We say, Chuck is coming. Ah, they were laughing at me. I said, my name is Abiodun. And if you guys don't call me that, I'm not answering. So I radically changed my name on one day. I even told my mother. And when I told my mother my name, I had changed my name. She said, you're crazy. I gave you your grandfather's name. Are you losing your mind? I said, my grandfather didn't know, and you didn't know. But my name is Abiodun, and that's what I'm going to be called. And if you call me anything else, I'm not going to answer you. And I got very, very strong about using my name, and I'm very proud of the fact that I did, because it has given me another level of understanding. It has taken me to heights that I never even imagined I could be, and I really have learned how to recognize the sound, and the rhythm of my name has given me a new rhythm in my life. So as I mentioned in this discourse, Abiodun means he who brings joy into the town. Oyewole means good fortune follows me.
Oh, man, that's really deep, man. You know, I was thinking about what you were saying in regards to, like, the respect for the women, right? Respect other for the women. I know, I understand in Yoruba, Yoruba is a real culture that geared toward the aspects of women, right? Especially in Ifa, you know. So, I just respect that what you were saying. Also, that the importance of a name, how it can transfer not only your life, but your mind. So, just first, your mind and your life and your community environment. You know, it's a transformation aspect, you know, and for real. So that's a beautiful thing.
It's necessary. I think it's necessary for all of us to investigate as much as we can about the motherland, because every single human being on this planet comes from Africa. And we need to recognize the gift that Africa has provided the world with. And we need to stop turning our backs on the motherland, because even today, after Africa has been raped so many times for its resources, for its people, which is a primary resource that they've gotten from Africa, which is us, and the gold and the diamond and the Ukraine and all the stuff, uranium, everything that this world needs to function with comes from the motherland. And as much raping that's gone on that continent, Africa is still filled with riches even now. That's why the Chinese are trying to buy in and invest as much as they can in Africa today. So we need to realize that we still hold the wealth of the world in our hands, and we need to actually relate to that and respect that and get on board to protect it.
True, indeed. Without a doubt, man. You know, without a doubt. You know, in this situation, man, you know, we first got to be in our right state of mind, which is our African state of mind, to be able to honor and respect the contribution that the motherland has contributed to world history, world society, and existence in general. You know, that's another thing about that transformation process and what you were just talking about. You went through going from the slave era to a new, to an African era.
Right.
You know, I want to ask you about, you know, I talked to your niece, and she had told me about the situation, right? I want to ask you about it in regards to, like, she said something about that she did rob the Klan, right? You know, I found that real interesting, right? You know,
what happened is, let me break it down, because I don't want anybody that's listening to misunderstand what went down. The fact is, I finished my education at Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, one of the places that you mentioned that we had, that some Black history event took place and was a part of your discourse before we got on air. I was listening to all the contributions that Black folks have made in the month of May that you carefully outlined. And in Raleigh, North Carolina, the Shaw University is a Black college that exists today. And I went there after I had been at Drake University, which is in Iowa. I had my full of white folks. Being a Drake, that's in Iowa, and it's got nothing but cornfields and white folks. And I got tired of being around those people. I wanted to be around my own. But I was totally shocked when I went to Shaw and found that we were practicing Greek, that we had all kinds of Greek fraternities, and brothers were stepping to, they had their Greek parties and all this kind of stuff, and they were branding Greek letters on their arm, and they were so proud to be Omegas and Kappas and Alphas and all that stuff. And I said, how come we're not practicing African societies? We have African societies like the Maasai, the Zulu, the Watusi, the Yoruba society. We need to start looking at our history in Africa and reproduce that as opposed to reproducing Greek stuff. We're not Greeks. And that Greek Western civilization is what's messing everything up. We're not from the West. We are from Africa. And so I started at Shaw University, a Yoruba society, because I'm also I'm one of the original investors of an African village that exists right now, and people can go see it. It's called Oyotunji, and it's in South Carolina, in Sheldon, South Carolina, and it's an African village that was actually erected in 1970. A lot of people don't know about it, but you can go online and see it. It's still doing. It's doing very well. The brother who gave me my. What you say?
Surgeon Adefumi started it. King Adefumi, Surgeon. Yes, sir.
Baba Surgeon Adefumi. That's the same brother who gave me my name. And when we were down in North Carolina together, he said he knew we were there under the auspices of the United Church of Christ. They were supposed to be building a transitional year academy, and Baba Osurgeman, and I called him Baba, he was down there with us because he said the program that the United Church of Christ, it was being headed up by the Committee for Racial Justice, was a branch of the United Church of Christ headed up by a Reverend Cobb, and it was a place used for the Black ministers to convene. It was like a resort for them to come and just chill and relate and relax, whatever. It had been a junior college. But now it was being used by the United Church of Christ for other things. They wanted to turn it into a transitional year academy, a place where Blacks in that area, like from infield little towns, and Black kids that were getting ready to go to college, when they leave those towns and go to college, they can't matriculate right away because they need remediation skills. So we were to give them their remediation skills and prepare them so that when they went into college, they could go right into matriculation and get their credits and graduate on time. But because in the Ifa divinations, in the Yoruba religion, you have the process of reading a situation. So Baba had read the situation. He says, this academy that they're trying to set up is never going to happen. And they're going to give us some money and send us back to where we came from. I'm going to arrange it so that they give us more money than they plan to. And I wanted to be down here because I get better readings down in the South. He says, all that metal up in the city kind of stops me from getting a clear reading. He says, I get better reads. Plus, I want to start a village. So I told Baba, I said, if you can get them to give us more money than what they're offering us, I will give you $1,000 towards the land so that you can start the village. And he did it just like it was magical how it all worked out. So he went down to South Carolina. And I went to Shaw University. I was still working under the United Church of Christ, and I was working as a college developer, and I was at Shaw, and I also was finishing up my education because I had not finished undergraduate work yet. So I'm finishing my education, and I'm living in a nice house, and I had transportation, everything. And I started the Yoruba Society, as opposed to dealing, I was actually in a war against all the Greek fraternities and the Greek sororities. And I would get on the steps of the student union, and I would just do impromptu speeches about how we need to be African people. And everybody in my society, they had to wear African clothes, and they had to have African names. I would send people to the village to learn more about the Yoruba culture and religion. Some of the folks got married in the village. I mean, it was really a serious cultural movement. And I would have these town meetings every Thursday just to inform the students and the professors who came to listen as to why I was trying to Africanize Shaw University. And I was so seriously gung-ho about this, and I had one of the young sisters, she says, well, you're wearing your African clothes now, and you ain't going to be dressed like that when December comes. It's going to be colder, and you're going to have to take off them dashis. You're going to be wearing clothes just like us. I said, oh, no, we're going to have African clothes even in December. So what I did, I got my young ladies that were in the group. I had about 50 people in my organization. And I had the young ladies go to Belk Tower, which is a big department store in Raleigh. And they bought some heavy material, and we made some winter dashikis and winter African garments. And we put on a fashion show. And the fashion show was such a big success. Now I've created a business because some of the professors and some of the students admired some of the clothes that had been made, and they started ordering clothes from us. All right. And so at one of my town meetings, I had some big mouth guys in the audience, and they said, so suppose the police vamp, because the term at that time was vamp. They said, suppose the police decide to vamp on your little cultural movement. You got some guns to protect your beautiful African women? I know you're going to hit them in the head with your afro. Oh, you got a bulletproof dashiki. They were making jokes. And I said, listen, anybody can get a gun. That's not my mission. I'm not trying to be a military operation. We're dealing with our culture. And so they were clowning me. And I, unfortunately, because I was stupid at that time, I took the bait. And I said, you know what? Just to be on the safe side, we need to get some guns. So I knew where the two gun shops were in Raleigh, Thorns and Dixies. I don't know if they exist anymore, but they were there at the time. And I devised a plan along with my brothers to rip off those two gun shops and take some guns, to have some guns. So I had sent out some people to do that. And they got the guns, and we were actually stashing them in the basement of Missouri Hall, which happened to be the basement of the president's mansion, because we had access to that space because that's where we did the newspaper. And I also did some writing for the newspaper just to keep the whole African conscious movement moving. And when I went on campus that morning, the coach of the football team says, they arrested two of your boys. They're in jail. Now, I'd heard before I got on campus that three of them had been arrested. I didn't realize that there was an informer in the organization, and that's how my boys got busted. I felt responsible because it was my plan. And what I did, I said, I got to get Bub and Marshall out of jail because they're going to be extradited. I knew they had some trail of stuff up in Pittsburgh, and I wanted to get them out of jail as quickly as possible. The bail bondsman, who usually bailed the students from Shore out, he wouldn't touch them because he felt he was going to lose some money. So I was trying to get the money. I went to the President Cheek. President King Cheek was the president of Shore at the time, and he said he was going to take care of it. I went back to him that afternoon, and his wife said he went to Detroit. He did not take care of it. I went to a friend of mine, a young lady that liked me. She was a professor, and she said she hadn't gotten her check yet, so she couldn't help me out. It was a long thing. Now, there was a demonstration when I first went to Raleigh of the Klan marching down Fayetteville Street. I had never seen the Klan march, and they had on their outfits like they were really Klansmen, and there were stones being thrown at them from behind me. The folks that were throwing stones at the Klansmen were white kids who were members of an organization called SDS. SDS stood for Students of a Democratic Society, and they hated the Klan. They were in line with black people because they knew that the Klan was vicious towards blacks, and they were trying to kill that. They didn't want that to happen. They didn't like them. And I went to one of the young men who had a stone in his hand getting ready to throw it. I said, man, you're going to start a riot. He says, man, I hate those folks. I worked for them last year, and they tried to recruit me. Man, I was raised in Brooklyn. I could never be in the Klan, and I hate them. And so he says, I know where their headquarters is, and we should torch their place. I thought about it, but I said, I'd never done anything with a white boy. But I said, well, where's their place? So he told me where their place was, and now I'm in need of money to get my boys out of jail. So I told my friend Alex, who is no longer with us, unfortunately, I said, listen, you got some guns, I got a gun. Let's change our clothes. Let's put on some clothes like we're doing some hunting or something and go get this money. And we can take it from the Klan, and we can get the boys out of jail. We kill two birds with one stone, embarrass the Klan, and get our boys out of jail at the same time. Because I knew they had a safe, and I knew they had collected some dues, so I figured they had some money there. Anyway, my plan went awry. We did get the money. They never got the money back, but there was a long search. We were on the run for like 8 hours. They finally caught us, and I had 12 to 20 years in the penitentiary in Raleigh. I only did 3 years and 9 months, but the fact is that I got busted. That was the story of the Klan. The fact is that I did, it was weird how I got respect, though, that no one else in prison at that time was getting. Because any time it was mail call, I never had to wait in a circle to hear my name called if I had a letter. If I had any mail, all I had to do was look under my pillow. And I would wonder how come I was getting a special privilege. And one of the brothers who I used to talk to in the prison, he said, Dune. He says, because everybody called me Dune. Well, they called me New York. When I was in prison down there, they called me New York. They said, New York, you don't know why you're getting this special privilege? I said, no. He said, man, you robbed the Klan. They respect you, man. You put a gun to those folks and took their money. Man, they have nothing but respect for you. People think you're crazy, but the Klan has much respect. And I guess that was the case because I never had to have my name called in that circle because people find out your business. If folks know your business, you could be set up for some other stuff. Nobody knew my business, but I got letters all the time, and I was treated much better than a lot of other folks. And I guess it was because I had shown some heart and some guts, and I had robbed the Klan. But I didn't see it as anything phenomenal. I just was trying to do what I thought was the right thing to do at the time. But using a gun is not my thing. That's not my style. But I had done it because I had been, as I said earlier, I bit the bait.
Wow. That's real interesting, man. That's real interesting, man. Form of resistance. That's real interesting.
Mm.
Hey, man, you said earlier that revolution is not just bloodshed, right? But that basically gaining some form of bloodshed, it could result in bloodshed or some kind of conflict. But, you know, that's a beautiful thing. That's way, that's a beautiful story, very inspiring. My next question is, right, tell us a little bit about Open House Sunday. What exactly is that? What was the purpose?
I started Open House about 40 years ago. I'm a big basketball fan and player. I love to play basketball. I play basketball in college, and I play basketball religiously every Sunday. And because I teach at Columbia University, I would have access to the gym. The rules are if you are a faculty member at Columbia, you have a chance to bring at least two guests with you to actually use the facilities. I would bring 15 brothers in that gym, and we would dominate. The white kids used to hate it because they knew they couldn't get down. We would control the gymnasium. And on one particular day, a young man came up to me. He said, hey, I know who you are, man. And I got a poem I want to share. I said, listen, brother, I'm glad you know who I am. That's really cool. I said, but right now, I can't hear no poetry. We're getting ready to play some poetry. I mean, you know, I'm not interested in a poem right now. I said, you know, let's play this game because I was into basketball. And so we played. He was on my team, matter of fact. And I remember we won some games, and he had a nice little game. And if you win, you know, that's how you stay on the court. Because if you don't win, that means you got to get winners, and you don't know when you're going to get back on the court. Because a lot of people waiting to play. But we had a great day, and we played well. And as we were changing clothes, getting ready to come home, I said, all right, let me hear that poem. So he reached into his pocket, and because we had played so hard, he was sweating. All of us were sweating. The sweat had evaporated his poem. All he had on the page was ink, and he couldn't decipher what the ink had once said. And I felt so bad because if I had listened to the poem when he first told me he had it, I would have been able to hear the poem and he would have been able to share it and we could have moved on. But now he looked like somebody had just stabbed him in the chest. And I felt real bad. So I said, listen, I'm going to take you to my house and I'm going to sit you at my desk. And I got a magical pen. I'm going to give you a special piece of paper. And since you wrote that poem, you will remember what you wrote and you will rewrite it. And I'm going to fix you some food. So that was the beginning of the open house. When he came here, and he said he remembered about 80% of the poem, and he wrote it down, and it was a decent poem. I can't remember what it was, but it was a decent poem. And it just started, and I found that some of the other boilers that were there with me were poets as well. And then I opened my doors to other poets to come over, and I began to, every Sunday I would get up early, and I make salmon croquettes and home fries, and then I got even added to the menu by doing some fried apples. And we'd go play basketball, come back to my house and eat, and then I'd open up the doors for us to do some poetry. And I would, and doing people that would read their poems, we would give them critique, give them some feedback on what the, how good the poem was, how effective it was, what they could do to make it better or whatever. And it just became a thing. And it built, and it grew as time went on, because there are a lot of people who write poetry, but they didn't get the feedback that they needed to know how their writings were. And so this became an essential part of our growth as a people. And I'm very proud of the fact that out of that, those Sunday open houses, many of the poets that I was working with, like Saul Williams and Jessica Kerr Moore, they have gone on to do phenomenal things because they have developed as super poets in the world. And I'm happy to say that I was one of the folks that gave them their genesis.
That's a beautiful thing. You know, I'm gonna get back to that. Possibly about up in the and I appreciate you for sharing your 91 understanding. You know, up in the go to the Brother Sharif, but I'm still leave your line open. Ask him a couple of questions. You know, I appreciate that, Baba.
Okay.
For the information. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Brother Sharif, how you doing, brother?
Yes, brother. Good, man. I can listen to Baba doing all night, man. So I was just, you know, reimagining. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah, the Baba re-agree out, man. Re-agree out, real storyteller, man. I love that. Love the information that was tradition. You know, my first question to you is, tell a little about the Liberation Bookstore that your family had. Tell about the Liberation Bookstore. You know, what's going on at the Liberation Bookstore, and what kind of inspiration did you get from it?
Liberation Bookstore was founded by my aunt Una Moza, my great aunt Una Moza. So she was my grandmother's sister, and she was the daughter of Captain Hugh Mozak, who was the first black captain of the ship in the United States. And, of course, they wouldn't let him, acquire and command his own ship until much later in his life. And he turned and became a Garveyite and was the first mate on the Yarmouth, one of the first ships acquired by Marcus Garvey. And he was a Garveyite and believed in repatriation back to Africa and had that consciousness. And passed that on to my Aunt Una. And the bookstore was founded in 1968. And I was born in 1969, so it was always in the presence of my family. And I left the country, and I grew up in Addis Ababa. I moved when I was 8, and my mother moved with my stepfather from Burkina Faso. He was from Ouagadougou, working for the UN. They transferred his post to, there. My mother was under the mind of returning back to the motherland as well, and took her 3 sons with her. And then when I returned, you know, it was more trying to readjust back to the United States and aspire in that capacity to relearn English. That's what brought me towards poetry, but I'll get into that a little bit more. And as I got older, I ended up learning a lot more at Liberation Bookstore and eventually working there. As an adult, and it was through Liberation Bookstore, through Una Mozak, and all the titles in there that my consciousness shifted. So largely in part, after relearning English and accommodating, I had a middle-class existence out on Long Island, aspiring to all the basic things that that we did at that time, pretty much on the American path. And I after Liberation Bookstore. It wasn't too long within a year of the American school system, you know, even after college that I was at SUNY Eldon Westbury. I learned more about the rebellion, slave rebellions, and about conscience and what had been done in imperialism in at Liberation Bookstore within a year. And that led me to poetry because I saw Sonia Sanchez over at the Schomburg. That same week, I went to a workshop at Frank Silvera's workshop. He used to have poetry and open mics at Frank Silvera's, and Abiodun was there, and I was much younger and still influenced, and I saw him read, and that was it. I decided right then to journey into spoken word, and got inspired a lot by Dune's work, by Sonia Sanchez, Amiri Baraka, all of whom used to come to Liberation Bookstore. And that, as a young man, began to influence and mold my train of thought, and eventually led me, fortunately, to enter into the craft and use my voice to feel inspired, and led me all the way to meet Dune, and he mentored a lot of us, like he mentioned Saul and Jessica and myself at the open houses, and led us all the way to where we are now. Yeah.
True indeed. You know, what did it actually mean to you to be a member of the Last Poet? What does that mean to you?
You know, it means a lot of things. Of course, to me personally, it means that the journey that I chose led me to a calling. So, it means really being present in the culture and staying in the culture and continuing that path. I remember hearing Niggas Are Scared of Revolution when I was 18 in the driveway. I was just relearning English at that time and really relearning language. And that gave me permission to enter into that space, to use thought and language to expand my emotions and my expression and how I felt about things and the passion about. And as I got older and understood, you know, what the sacrifice they were making, the conversation they were having, the truth that we were deconstructing, to be a part of it now is really an affirmation. And reaffirms a lot of what I was imagining was wrong with this space, and finding a way to redefine that and have a new conversation about it. So being a Last Poet is not just an affirmation for my own voice, but a continuation of the culture, the way Dune is imagining it, extending it to another generation. I'm honored and proud about it.
True indeed. You know, that's a beautiful thing, man. You know, you gotta carry on a legacy, man, especially as a positive and upliftment legacy, right? You know,
exactly.
But I understand that you made your debut with the Last Poet when you performed when the Revolutionary Calm, right? I think that took place in Brazil or something like that. Tell a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that moment was a special moment for me. That was the poem, the very first poem, that I heard again as an adult, you know, grown in. And so being on stage with these brothers, being able to, the meaning and the presence of that is just affirming in different ways. It's like, you know, it's to me, it was an extension of continuing the culture. It was the final full circle of me arriving into that space, and it was a really honor to be on stage with David and with Abiodun and speaking those words and reimagining them right back into coming out of my mouth from what I inspired is an affirmation of the full culture circle of being present in the craft. So I was really grateful for that.
Okay. That question.
I'd like to add something to that, if possible.
Go ahead, Baba.
Yeah. The fact is that Sharif is an excellent poet, and he has a presence that alone by himself commands attention. And he knows how to write. He knows how to present in a way that is You know, everybody who writes poetry can't present their poetry. A lot of people would be shocked to find out, as great as Langston Hughes was, you did not want to hear Langston Hughes read his poetry. It would turn you off. He wrote great. You know, he wrote wonderfully, but he had no presentation. I bought an album by Langston Hughes thinking I was going to go to heaven, and I went, and he took me on a nosedive that blew me away. He did not have a voice to read his own work. If you really wanted to appreciate Langston Hughes, you had to listen to Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee do his work. But Sharif has a pen that's on fire. He can write, and then he can present. And the people loved him. I mean, he holds his own. And so I felt extremely thankful, to be honest, that he embraced the idea of being a last poet, because I'm looking at the future. I'm not going to be here forever. I mean, I don't know how long. I don't know when the clock is going to strike 12. But the last poets is beyond just a group. It's an institution. And it represents a certain philosophy. And Sharif, he has poetry that speaks to the philosophy of the last poets. Just like Gil Scott-Heron, his poetry spoke to the philosophy of the last poets. When Gil Scott-Heron and I were on stage about 2 years before he died, the paparazzi asked Gil, he says, "Are you a last poet?" And Gil said, "Yeah, I'm a last poet." Then he looked at me, and I said, "Yes, Gil is a last poet." No, he's not running around functioning in the group, but philosophically, he's saying the same thing that I'm saying, and he is a last poet because of that. Sharif has been writing and performing for quite some time. And when he mentions the Liberation Bookstore, that's the same place where I was nurtured as well. And Una was a very dear friend. Matter of fact, Una used to babysit my son because we lived across the street from the bookstore. The Liberation Bookstore was a vital part of the Harlem community, because if you wanted to get some information about black folks, that was the place to go. And for me to have chosen Sharif to be in The Last Poets, with his cachet, with his history, it is absolutely perfect. Una was a dear, dear friend of mine. She was somebody who was vitally important to my existence. And that's when I was also introduced to Sonia Sanchez through Una. She was a very important person. And know that a relative of hers is going to help keep this name alive gives me real great satisfaction and joy. So I just wanted to just say that Sharif is more than worthy. He is keeping the legacy alive, and he can handle it because he is prepared and he was made for this moment.
I say, brother, thank you so much, Doom. I really appreciate that. It means a lot. With the powerful words and powerful affirmation to the continuation of the culture. I'm inspired by that. A lot of that, you know, raised me. You know, this is the voice that I have that, I, as Doom mentioned, as family. So it's within the construct of how I imagine arriving. So when you ask me what it feels like to be a last poet, it feels like an arrival, you know, an arrival into the space that has been nurturing me for a long time.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Man, this is wonderful, man. You know, this is beautiful. Sharif, what is your name? What does Sharif mean? What does that actually mean, you know?
Sharif in Arabic means a nobleman. It's rooted in honesty, an honest nobleman, which is where the root of the word sheriff they use here, they bastardized it in the United States and turned it into something different. But Sharif is the nobleman.
Okay. Okay. Appreciate that. Can you tell us about the Birmingham Arts and Music Festival? You know what I'm saying? Something you created. Tell us a little about it. Why was it created? What does it actually mean?
The Birmingham Arts and Music Festival, BAM, was something I put together when I was living in Birmingham, Alabama, down south, and in Alabama. And when I was working down there, I saw a void. You know, of inspiration, where people, that system there was really the way in which communities were organized. They'd have these really dramatic disparities of wealth, in one side of the neighborhood and the next side. And I wanted to pull people together and pull black folks together primarily to have access largely to a lot of these centers that were not being open to them to generate more income and more ways of imagining the expression of the craft. And so Birmingham Arts and Music Festival came about where we celebrated the local music, the people who were there. And I had a vision of pulling together artists from various different genres and hip-hop and blues and funk and soul. And that ran for about 5 years in Birmingham and showcased a lot of that work.
Okay. You know, I want to go back to something you had said, right? You were stating that you had to relearn English again, right? What do you mean by that? You know, can you expound more on that? You know what I'm saying? For the people who are listening to the future, what you had to relearn English, what do you mean by that?
So when I was in the Ethiopia, I went there when I was 8, and I came back when I was 13. And my mother put me, we were part of a program with the United Nations. So I was in the international school, and I went to the French school for several years. And eventually, English no longer became my primary language. French became my primary language, and Amharic became my secondary language, the Ethiopian native tongue, Amharic. So I spoke that more. And when I returned back to the United States, I had to relearn largely when you live in an African nation, you know, you have access to a different identity. I didn't necessarily have a lot of the obstacles racially that we had here. And so relearning not only the language, but the position that we had to take here, which was a little bit more conscious. You had to be more aware and more defensive about your identity here, and that language infused inside of me literally learning English again and using it as a mechanism to operate through the United States as I got older. And that ultimately led me to poetry, because it was as I relearned English that I understood what you can do with language. That Dune talked about me writing and expressing myself. I had to use that as a form of describing my environment and what the environment was. And that's what I mean, more or less literally, relearning English but using it as a different form of expression. Ntozake Shange would always say this language, the same language that oppresses us would be the same language we use to free ourselves. And that led me all the way into, you know, my conversations with the last poets and arriving into this space. So that's what, I'm relearning literally the language and using it as a tool for expression and for liberation, my own personal liberation.
Okay. I appreciate that. I heard talk about the song. I heard talk about the performer called The Journey. Right. What exactly is The Journey? You know, what exactly is that that is to you besides just the words?
The Journey, that particular piece. It really is about sacrifices. I think our journey is infused with sacrifice. You know, Dune tells a great story about the sacrifices he made and the price he paid for that sacrifice, for being present and looking back. And he had to sacrifice a period of his freedom for that. And so there's that idea of the journey being the sacrifice and what we sacrifice here. For example, you know, even growing up as an artist or as I entered into that space and chose poetry as a vocation, it's not always rewarded monetarily, that what you're receiving is a sacrifice to speak your truth and adding that truth to a broader part of the culture. So being in The Last Poets now, the continuation of the culture, that's part of the journey I was referring to, journeying through that space and the sacrifice that comes along. And that piece in particular that you may have heard was written for the World Games that I performed in front of in 2000, about 2 years, last year actually. The World Games came to Birmingham, Alabama, and I wrote that about the sacrifices the athletes make. Dune and I have that in common. We enjoy sports and we understand the competitive nature of that. And that piece, The Journey, was about the celebration of that sacrifice and the energy that you need to put into achieving these higher goals. And, you know, I really feel part of that journey is arriving to this point in my life where I have a great platform that has been bestowed on me, a great honor, and I can continue in that tradition of the journey, which is largely a sense of sacrifice, what you have to give up to move forward.
You know, any time you commit yourself to something of value, there's going to be a sacrifice. In a relationship, when you love somebody, when you have a woman in your life that you care about, if you really do care about her, there's going to be some sacrifice. You cannot have a healthy relationship being selfish. You have to be selfless. And you're going to this particular show that we're doing right now, this conversation that we're having with you right now, brother, is a sacrifice. The Knicks are playing basketball, and I'm a big basketball fan, and the Knicks are getting ready to get kicked out of this year's tournament, because if they don't win this game, it's going to be over for them. And I said, when Juanita told me that I had a radio call tonight at 8 o'clock, I said, why tonight? Oh, my God, the Knicks are playing. but the truth is that that's a sacrifice, because the sports for us is really it kind of rejuvenates us. It's something that we need, because we know that when the brothers are on the court, it's like an African dance. We've changed this game. This game is nothing like Nate Smith invented it. Black folks, whenever we get a hold of anything, we change it, because we have a certain magic, a certain kind of gift to listen. We're the only people on the planet who have taken the language, like when Sharif was talking about language and how he had to relearn English. You have to not only relearn English, but when you're in the black world, you got to recognize how black people have changed English entirely. We're the children of bad. There is no culture on the planet that's taken a perfectly negative word and made it perfectly positive. But us, when we say something is bad, we don't mean it's negative. We mean it's very good. If we say something that's dope, we're not talking about somebody shooting drugs or being stupid. We're talking about something that's wonderful. I mean, we've taken this inferior language to our existence and made it positive, just because that's the only way we can soothe and satisfy our souls. So we've taken the guts of a pig and made it a delicacy. I don't eat chitlins, but a whole lot of our people have been raised on chitlins because that was available to us when nothing else was. So we are a very special people, and it's important that we know, yes, sacrifices are going to be made, but those sacrifices are worth it when you look at the picture, when you look at the overall picture. You got to make a sacrifice, and along with the sacrifice comes some discipline. Those are some things that we're trying to work with our people now, to learn how to be disciplined, to learn how to make the proper sacrifice and stop trying to merge and be something that you're not. I'm talking to sisters who are wearing those Japanese fans on their face. They call them false eyelashes. Why are you trying to look like a Barbie doll? Why are you wearing a wig that's got the part down the middle and your hair hanging down? When in the 60s, when we started dealing with our black culture, as we were talking about in this discussion, it was scaring the hell out of white people. They said, oh, my God, the black people are not even trying to look like us anymore. They were wearing their hair natural. And then white folks started trying to wear their hair natural. It wasn't working. You even have some white boys that are trying to lock their hair like Bob Marley. I mean, they will follow our lead. We don't need to follow them. And we need to recognize we are the straw that stirs the drink, and we happen to be the drink that's being stirred.
Yes, sir. True indeed.
That's true indeed. This is true.
True
so
indeed.
Sacrifice is key. We got to make sacrifices. If we want to see anything accomplished, there will be some sacrifices. There's some things that I have to spend money for that I don't particularly like, because I like to save my money for other things. But then I say, what is money? Money is an illusion to begin with, and we hold on to it just to say we got money. No, it's a tool. It's a hammer and a nail. You don't worship money, but there are a lot of people who do worship money. Before I do interviews, my niece, who you spoke to, Juanita, she knows. She says, "Well, how much? What kind of compensation is my uncle going to get?" She makes sure that I get paid for every time I open my mouth. She says, "When you do stuff, other people are getting paid having you on their show, or having you interviewed for their magazine or their paper." But when I saw that this was dealing with George Jackson, when I saw that this was something that was a people's radio station, I said, no, let it be, because I want to talk on this. I want to be a part of this. So, yes, that's a sacrifice unto itself. Normally, if I'm going to run my mouth like this, I'm going to get paid on some level to cover some expenses. I got a TV that I got to pay for in order to watch. It makes no damn sense. I didn't grow up paying for television. It was a part of my electric bill. you know. But now they got this thing so hooked up where every time you open your mouth, every time you say something, somebody's got to give you some money or something. In this particular case, you say, you know what? This is a brother. This is a situation where these brothers and sisters are trying to raise the consciousness of our folks. And if we can make a contribution to that, then that's perfect. And that's a sacrifice. But it's a necessary sacrifice that I don't mind having.
I say, yes, sir. We appreciate it, bro. Yes, sir. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I got one more question for both of y'all. Then I'm going to open the line for a few callers. In regards to the situation that happened with the brother being choked out by the European, what are y'all thoughts about that? I'm just
that's a lynching. That's a lynching. That's all it is. That's a lynching, a 2023 old-fashioned lynching, but it was done with a chokehold. This guy's a Marine, and he was trained how to take people out by putting them in chokeholds. And everyone that uses that chokehold knows that after a certain amount of time, the person is no longer breathing. You are dead. You can't hold anybody in a chokehold for 15 minutes and expect them to live. That was a killing. And he took advantage of a young black man who was actually not even big. If he had some girth, that wouldn't have happened like that. But this is a slender brother, a slight brother, who's on the train singing. If you've ever been in New York City, there are a lot of people who use the subway as a place to make some money. They'll sing, they'll dance, they'll do a whole lot of things to try to get some dollars to take care of their lives. New York City has over 55,000 homeless people. And Jordan Neely was a homeless young man, and he was using the train as a stage to make money. He had Michael Jackson down. He did his moves. He sung his songs. His father was a member of a group that my son had called Asante. You can check out the archives of Soul Train. They were on there once, and they did a piece called Look What You've Done, and they did a piece with the Fugees. And Lauryn Hill loved my son. I mean, she was truly in love with him. But the fact is that the leader of this group is named Andre, and his son was Jordan Neely, the young man who was killed. They've been having demonstrations ever since that particular killing took place, because the people are irate. The people, and I'm talking about, when I say people, I'm talking about black people, white people, Asian people, Latin people. The streets have been flooded with crowds of people who are very upset that the person that did this killing, the perpetrator, has not been arrested, has not been charged. He is walking around scot-free.
I can't get my head around that, dude. I still...
It's insane, but that's what this is. This was a lynching. If it had been the other way around, if Jordan had done this to this white boy and had killed him, he would be in jail right now. But though Jordan was killed by this white boy, and consequently, they looked at him as a good Samaritan, because Jordan was on the train, and he was frustrated. He's homeless. He's singing, but he's got some mental issues. But people know his history. His mother was killed in a most horrendous way. She was not only killed, but she was chopped up and put in a bag and placed underneath a trestle here in New York. And her son knows that. This happened when he was 14 years old, and he's lived with that. And just like Malcolm X's mother went insane when she saw Malcolm's father's head being crushed by the train. And you can't, those images don't leave your mind, and it does drive you crazy. And so Jordan has some mental illness, but mental ill people are not attended to in New York City. They are left to just be left alone. They roam the streets. They ride the subway. And then they try to dehumanize us. And they talk about how many times he was arrested, 44 arrests. Yeah, but for menial stuff, like maybe jumping the turnstile, he wasn't arrested for killing anybody, for doing anything that was vicious. The boy is not a vicious kid. He's simply trying to survive. And in his effort to survive, he may have started ranting and raving. He may have been talking real loud, but so what? He speaks, so you're going to kill everybody that raises their voice? You're going to need a whole, that's a whole lot of killing going on, because there's a lot of people that raise their voice all the time. And if you don't like what somebody's saying, if you don't like how somebody smells, you get out of that train and you move into another car. No. You don't kill him. But he was killed. It was not a mistake, as far as I'm concerned. I even have some black folks say, well, I don't think he meant to kill him. I don't think he did not mean to kill him. Because he was trained to kill. and he put him in a chokehold that took his life. The same thing with Eric Garner out in Staten Island. That cop was there to kill him. He saw a big
and
black man.
A video, and they still didn't arrest this man. He's choking him in the video.
Yes, and he held him down. They had two people holding him. He was a slight young man. I don't know if he weighed 120 pounds. And he was held down and choked to death. He didn't have a weapon on him. He had not put his hands on anybody. There was no reason. If he didn't harm anybody, why harm him? If he's causing a disturbance and you don't want him on that train, well, if you think he's causing a big disturbance, all right, then hold him and let the cops come and deal with that. But no, they didn't do that. They took him out. They took him out. And it was a deliberate move, and it's another slap in the face to black people. And this happens more often than not. We've seen it before. We got a whole list of many brothers and sisters who have been killed by so-called good Samaritans, like Zimmerman killing Trayvon Martin. And they got to stand your ground rule. There's a bunch of cases that happen that we don't even know about. We know about this because many of the New York subway riders look forward to hearing Jordan because he sounded a lot like Michael, a handsome kid. He even wore the clothes that Michael would wear. He did a lot to, like, imitate Michael and relive the whole essence of what Michael Jackson was all about. And that, unfortunately, he got taken out. And it was unnecessary, and there's no justice, and the people right now are demanding justice. I truly hope something happens. My son is a lawyer, and he's on the case, and they're trying to make something happen to make sure that this guy will be held accountable for his actions. But just like Donald Trump said about himself, he could shoot somebody, kill him in broad daylight, and nothing would happen. That's the same thing that's happening with this kid. The racial tension in this country is alive and well and has not gone away, and we need to recognize that. There are some white folks who happen to be human, but there are a whole lot that are not. And those who are not are causing a lot of trouble, and they're going to continue to do so. And the only way that we're going to stop this is by just stop believing that they are that they have any good intentions on our behalf, because they don't. We need to look out for each other and try to protect each other as much as we possibly can.
True indeed. I'm going to totally agree with everything you just said, Baba. You know, at this time, I'm going to open the line up for a few callers. If you got any questions, comments, statements, or want to join dialogue, please press 1. I'm going to open the line up. Any questions, comments, statements at this time, please press 1. Open the line up. If anyone got any question, comment, or statement, please press 1 at a time over your line up.
So maybe we were a little too much. Maybe we said so much they can't digest what we said. Well, you know, that's another situation, because there should be some dialogue. There should be somebody with some kind of question. I mean, I would be really remiss not to think that somebody would have something on their minds to say. You have a pretty good listening audience?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Hold up. Yeah. Hold up. Let me see. Your line is open. Go ahead.
Peace and blessings, beloved.
Peace and blessings.
Yes, I just want to say black power and one love to the family. Thank you so much for speaking on Brother Jordan Neely and his murder. Thank you for everything that you both shared. You said so much, it's hard to capsule it for me, but I've loved you all forever, and I pray that, as you said, the last words are an institution, and we pray that the institution goes on into generations untold. And I also pray that your son is able to give the family and friends and loved ones of Brother Jordan Neely some assistance, because the soldier is, in my opinion, he shouldn't even be able to continue to live in New York. If he doesn't go to trial, he shouldn't be welcome in New York. So, and I won't take it much further than that, but you feel me?
Yeah, I hear you, brother. Well, I appreciate that, and thank you for giving a blessing to the poets, because we are here for, we're only here because the people have endorsed us. When we put out our very first album in 1970, it sold 1 million copies. There was no social media at that time. So we're talking about an album that sold 1 million copies by word of mouth. And anytime people walk up to me and say, man, when I heard you guys, you changed my life. I said, yeah, you changed my life. I hadn't planned to run around the world running my mouth. I said, but because you bought 1 million copies of what I had to say, it gave me a platform to continue to run my mouth and say stuff. So by you giving us a blessing, brother, I want to give it right back to you. We need each other. I got one mouth, and you got two ears. And your two ears decide to listen to what me and Sharif are saying. That's a blessing for us. Because if we could be talking to the wall, and it's not going to respond. We're trying to reach our people. We want dialogue. We want people to think. We want people to grow. And we want people to learn how to love each other, because that's the only way that we're going to make it.
I yes, said, did you come to Baltimore with the last force the last time they were here at the U.B. Blake Museum?
Yes, brother. Yes, most likely, yes. If the last poets were functioning, I mean, yes, I'm one of the founding members of the group, and then
I go back with the last poets and that first album you were talking about, and every other album, and I don't remember. I'm having brain fog right now.
Don't worry about it. That's okay. Yeah. We all go through that. But yes, the other matter of fact, I just want to say that one of the brothers in the group actually lived in Baltimore, and that's Umar Ben Hassan, the brother who's responsible
brother
for the poem.
Yes, sir. He lives on Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm familiar with Brother Umar, and that's
right.
That's who I was about to ask you about. How's he doing?
Yes, well, he's got some health challenges. He had a stroke, but he's recuperating. I haven't heard from him in the last few days. I did call him, and I'm waiting for a response. I'm going to try to call his daughter and find out what's going on with him, because we got some gigs coming up, and if he's capable, I would like for him to be there if at all possible. But I don't know if he's capable, because he definitely has gone through some changes, and it might not be possible for him to be there. But he is responsible for what... He is responsible for the piece that I call the anthem of the last poets, which is Niggas Are Scared of Revolution. Matter of fact, when we go to Europe, yeah, white people that yell out, are you going to do Niggas Are Scared of Revolution? I mean, everybody everybody in the world knows that poem. And Umar is the author of that piece. And that will go down. It'll be here longer than any of us, because it's a piece that speaks truth to power without question.
Sir, well, being the most high, keep you all strong and safe and well, and traveling mercies with you wherever you go to take the message.
Thank you, brother. Thank you very much for that.
God bless. God bless you too, brother.
Yes, sir. Peace and blessings. All right, beloved. I talk to you, Bomani.
Anyone else?
Hello, go ahead.
Yes, can y'all hear me?
Yeah, we
can
hear you, Mom.
This is Elder Mama Condi, and Brother Sharif and Baba Abiodun. It's really good to hear y'all again. I go back with y'all to teenage. I was living in Philly, and I used to come up to New York and spend time and hang out with y'all at Liberation Bookstore. Not as much there, though. I used to hang out at Kanye's more.
Uh-huh, yeah, the Tree of Life.
Queen Mother Moore used to, her and Father John Henry Clark, and they used to do free sessions at Conyers. And so I spent a lot of time there, and then I was also being initiated into Ifa, so I would go and spend time with Ia Ojo Kamara.
Oh, beautiful.
Being initiated into Ifa. Mm-hmm. So, and then more recently, David invited me to St. Louis because I've written a book about polygyny, and they had a panel and conference, and I was the only sister. There was about seven brothers on the panel, and I was the only sister on the panel.
Wow.
And I talked about what happened to me because I'm a MOVE supporter, and how my children and I were trampled on horseback, and I was beaten in a miscarriage. And so they were very receptive to me. Last time I talked to you, Baba Abiodun, was on Sister Filet's show.
Okay.
Maybe nine months or so ago. And I'm just enjoying this. It's bringing back a lot of memories. And it's just really good to hear y'all. I'm blind now, so I don't write as much.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, bless you, sweetie. And I'm still swinging.
All right. That's beautiful.
Good to hear that.
That's excellent.
Bless y'all. It's really good to hear y'all.
Well, thank you so much. And Pam Africa is one of my super sister friends, and she was part of that movement.
Yes.
And I'm in touch with the sister that runs the National Million Women's organization. So Philadelphia is one of my special places because that's where they had the very first Black Power conference. I'll never forget how we performed
there.
Yeah, it was a very special moment.
Church of the Advocate.
Yes, it was a very special moment in time. And I really am very grateful for Philly. Philly's always been a super funky town that's always had something significant to say. Plus, you had that police chief named Rizzo, who was the first first police chief to use canines in breaking up black crowds. And he had those dogs out. And it was very sick. But at the same time, the Philadelphian folks, my grandfather lived in Philadelphia, and you're some resilient people. The people in Philly are not to be confused with weakness, because there is a strength there that a lot of people seem to underestimate. But I'm very happy to talk to you, and I'm very happy to know that you know many of the same people that I know, because they've always been about it. And just continue on and be blessed and do what you got to do, and may the blessings of all the ancestors and your Orishas be with you.
Oh, bless you, bless you. That is very kind. I want to say one more thing, and that is I was so young at the Black Power Conference that they paid me out of petty cash. I worked in the kitchen. I fed y'all.
Wow, okay.
But I was so young. That's what they did. That's how they resolved that problem. That was my first job where I got paid.
Wow. I had a lot of memories there.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'll continue to strive, sister. Keep on striving.
Oh, one question.
How is
David?
David is fine. Matter of fact, David performed with us in Brazil, and he was on stage with us performing, and he's hanging tough. He's in Phoenix, I think, right now, and he's doing his thing. He's very much alive and well. And I was happy to be with him on stage. We had, because Umar is under the weather, so we had I got David to actually take his spot. But because, and David, I've always given him credit for being the father of the last show, because it was David's calling that caused us to come together. He was the one with the idea of putting a collective together to create what we now know as the Last Poets. So He always gets my respect, and he always gets a shout-out from me. Anytime I perform, I have to mention his name, because without him, there wouldn't be The Last Poets.
And it was a true honor to be on stage with him.
Yeah, he's beautiful. He's the one who brought me to St. Louis for the panel discussion.
Right.
He's always been close. I lost contact when I got attacked by the state, and he moved to Israel.
Right.
So we lost contact.
Yeah, he was living in Israel because he's a black Hebrew, and he was there for some time. And he's also a part of the vegetarian restaurant, so because he's a vegan. And he's doing his thing. He's been consistent about being as righteous as he can. And I appreciate him very, very much. He lost a son, but that hasn't stopped him from continuing. Yeah, he lost one of his sons. And I forget what the cause was, but he has continued to move forward in spite of all of that. But like we say, in this world, if you're doing anything worthwhile, even if you're not, there will be a sacrifice that we're going to have to make. And we have to adjust, and we have to deal from that perspective that sacrifice is going to take place, and how we adjust to those sacrifices will determine what's going to happen in our personal future. So David is hanging in there. As I said, he's still writing, he's still performing, and he's still good. So I'm very grateful. And he's like about 10 years older than me, but he has his energy, his vitality is still there.
Yeah, he's my elder brother as well. Bless y'all, and I'm going to yield now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good evening.
Freeline, I appreciate that, Elder Mama Kanye. Appreciate that.
I
should have another question myself, right? When you hear the name George Jackson, what did that mean to y'all? What does the name George Jackson mean to y'all?
You know, there was a time when I wanted to do a whole play about a great love story between George and Angela Davis, because I know from letters, they were lovers. Politically, they were lovers. But the love that they had was the sharing and understanding of what their people needed, because Angela was a super political analyst, very, very brilliant. And unfortunately, she's taken a road that I can't exactly endorse, because she married a white woman, I understand, and she's doing some other things. But when she was communicating with George through the letters, it was a very special relationship that they had. And I always think about it. And when I think of George, I also think of his brother Jonathan, and how Jonathan actually went out of his way to free his brother from jail and went to the Marion County Courthouse strapped with a sawed-off shotgun and dealt with the judge and made him actually give up try to give up the brothers and get them out of the courtroom. And they ended up killing a lot of people. I think Michelle McGee was the only one that survived because he used the judge as a shield. But they opened fire on the van and killed everybody. And George was not at court that day. But Jonathan still is a little along with his plan. So George Jackson brings out a lot of memories, because even when he was incarcerated, he was still about trying to do something to help the liberation of his brother. So that love for his brother and George's relationship with Angela, those are two things that stand out the most for me that I will never forget. I will always have in my mind, because I think that even incarcerated, he made a strong impact on the Panthers and the rest of us who were not even involved with the Panthers. The impact will last forever in my mind, because he was a brother that continued to be about the work of liberating his people.
My Aunt Una, when I first got to Liberation Bookstore, after living on Long Island and largely not really being raised wholly in the consciousness movement, she gave me Soul Dad Brothers. So when I hear George Jackson, excuse me, I'm a little out of breath, I had to move my car. I hear George Jackson, you know, that's my was
one of my first entryways into the consciousness I have now, the sacrifice that you have to make to stand up for your rights with him and his brother. Soul Dad Brothers. That book changed everything. It put an arc on and crystallized the country I had been returned to. Like I said, when I was relearning English, I was also relearning the culture here and what our positions are. And that every time I hear it, and I was excited when I was going to be on his namesake radio station to say that and commemorate how much I appreciate his sacrifices.
You know, the person can die physically, but I always tell people the only way that you're truly remembered for anything is you got to put in the work. George put in the work,
yeah.
And consequently,
yeah,
because of the work that he did, he will never die. Just like Malcolm and Martin, those folks, you can kill the body, but the idea and the spirit of those individuals will inspire many, many people who are living to go forward. And that's what the work does. But if you do no work, you may be forgotten about. But if you work, you will never be forgotten. And so they come here, we come on this planet to do a particular assignment. If we do our assignments well, then that gives us immortality. George is a member of that group of immortal brothers because of the work that he did, as well as he's in the same category with Malcolm and Martin and a host of other brothers that have done the work. And I'm proud to read his work, to know, and he developed his skills. His skills were off the chain. If anybody's ever read anything that George has written, because I always tell people, when you go to prison, you don't go to prison and serve time. That's corny. That's weak. You go to prison to get time to serve you. Everybody that's locked up, they've got something that people on the outside don't have. They got time.
Mm.
Time to develop themselves, time to work on their craft, time to meditate, time to discover a self that they have never discovered before, because all of the things that they are used to doing in their physical world are no longer available to them. So when they lock you up and they think they're depriving you from something, they really give you an opportunity to discover some more gifts that the gods have given you. And George discovered his gift, and he had a gift for writing that was so special. And he could communicate with a pen in ways that many of us cannot do today. So I'm proud of the fact that we have all been privy to some of his work, and he will live in our lives forever just because of the work that he left behind.
Amen, brother. I say.
True indeed, man. I got a question for you, Bob Abaddon. You know,
yes, sir.
I remember I looked at the video of B-Tay-Q that was by M1 and Divine RBG, right? And I seen you in there teaching in the classroom. What were you talking about in that classroom on the video?
Oh, yeah, that was done by Jamal Joseph. You know, I mean, it was probably something dealing with liberation. I don't remember exactly because I just happened to be in that video. I did another video with Dead Prez. And it was a piece called Mind Sex, where they talk about you have to take your clothes off and talk about having mind sex, not getting caught up with that physical relationship. And that was Black Rose was a poem I did in that one. But in this particular video where I'm teaching a class, it was about, most likely it was about something dealing with our liberation, because the video was done right there on Lenox Avenue. And I would not be saying anything to the kids that would be opposed to liberation. If I'm talking at all, I'm definitely saying something to try to make us recognize the beauty of our blackness, because that's my whole theme right now. I want us to see how beautiful we are. I want us to recognize that ugly is not something that we should endorse on any level. We are people who need to recognize all the gifts that we've been given and to work with those gifts to try to help ourselves grow and share the growth that we have made with others so they can grow too. So I can't tell you exactly what I was saying, but I do know it was something significant, because when I open my mouth, I always try to say something that makes sense.
Okay. I got you. Now, I was just curious. I know I saw the video years ago. I was just curious, right, you know?
Yeah, I know the reason that they had me in the teaching situation is because of all the things that I do, even though I'm a poet and I sing, I love the arts. My real passion is teaching, and that's what I really have a strong passion for teaching, because I believe I can communicate points that many others have a problem doing, and I've had the pleasure and the joy of reaching some kids to the point where I've had students come up to me after 30 years. I mean, I've had folks that I haven't seen for 30 years come up to me talking about a lesson or a poem or a song or something that I've sung or did for them, and they still remember. And it blows my mind how people – but if you do the work and you do something that's significant, it will last forever. And I've had that experience. So teaching for me is the greatest gift that I think I have, because I'm pretty good at teaching. I love teaching, because actually I don't even see myself as a teacher as much as I see myself as a facilitator. I want to say something to help you teach yourself, and then take that lesson that you've learned and help others grow using it, because each one of us should share what we can so that others can learn how to share what they can with others who need to know so that they can grow as well. So facilitating is really what I do, to make it possible for you to teach yourself so that you don't make the mistakes that you made yesterday.
I say, you know, I agree with that, Dune. I'm a teacher and a facilitator. I've always referred to myself a facilitator more than that, because it's an exchange. You're learning from somebody else even while you're teaching them. And no matter what age they are, you're a passionate, but you're learning.
That's right.
You know, I learned a lot. I was doing work at Sentinella State Prison outside of San Diego, California, and there was an exchange there where I really got to learn, you know, some of the sacrifices the brothers were making down, you know, while they were there up against this institution, and them speaking directly to how they felt about it. And I learned a lot. And in exchange, I facilitated them expressing their art form. So I agree with you with that, Dune, that we do a lot more facilitation than any other teaching course.
Matter of fact, you know, one of the things I say, Sharif, to my class, whatever class I'm teaching, I'll go in and the first thing I say, I'm here to teach you guys how to deal with creative writing. And I'm going to teach you all the figurative language and all that stuff. I said, but I expect to learn more from you than you're going to learn from me, because each one of you have something to teach me that I don't know. And that, you know, you want to empower your students. You know, unfortunately, the system that they call education in this country, they see our kids as empty vessels, and they got to fill them up with something. And that's not the case. Our kids are not empty vessels. Our children have a whole boatload of experiences that need to be tapped and that need to be recognized. And people need to recognize none of our children are dumb. Even those kids sitting in those special ed classes, a whole lot of folks say, oh, they're non-functional, they can't think, and they have to be here. Then they have to sit, they act out, they put them in timeout. And timeout is just sitting in a room all by yourself and not doing nothing. It's fake. And the deal is that I've been able to reach these kids and help them recognize they all have something of worth and value that we need to recognize and always cherish. And I try to bring that out in them. Once you empower the children and give them a sense of their worth, and they realize that they're worth more than what they've been told, you'd be surprised at what they can do, how they can continue to develop on their own, because now they feel better about themselves.
Sir, yes, sir. The babies are the greatest, like Father Love said, the babies are the greatest. You know, he even said it, the revolution in the hand of the youth.
Absolutely.
No, I think we got about 11 minutes left, right? You know, and I got a request before I give y'all final thoughts. I want y'all final thoughts, right? I just want to, request that y'all give a couple of words of the poetry, man. Just a few vibrations, man. If you give a few vibrations, man. Just somebody owe my quest here.
Well, you know, I have this thing called the pledge that I do every time we have a meeting. And when I have an open house, one of the first things I do with the open house is a pledge. The pledge, I don't pledge allegiance to the flag, and I don't sing that star-strangled banner. And so I'm always asked to be a speaker in different situations, and I was asked to be a speaker at a graduation, and I had not sung the pledge. I mean, I didn't do pledge allegiance to the flag, and I didn't sing the song. And so when the principal called me up, and I was considered the favorite poet of the school, and the teachers applauded, the parents applauded, the place was crowded, it was a graduation, and I was a keynote speaker. But when I got up to the microphone, a little girl raised her hand in the audience out of 1,500 people, and she says, "You didn't pledge allegiance to the flag." And I said, "Ain't this a trip?" The girl threw me under the bus. And so in defense of what I didn't do, I said, "I didn't pledge allegiance to that flag because it's never pledged allegiance to my people." And some people started to clap, and then some of the teachers stopped clapping because they thought they might lose a check. And so then I said, "Besides, I got a much better pledge than the Pledge of Allegiance." I didn't have anything. I just had my big mouth, but my mind, my brain was working, thank God, and I made up a pledge that's probably one of the best things I've ever freestyled. So I would like to just share that with you before we close out. And Sharif has heard the pledge many times, and it's very simple. I want to be what I can be, to be proud, healthy, and free. I want to say what I know to help my brothers and sisters grow. I want to feel good about me and blame no one for my misery, because I'll be strong to turn it around. I want to go up. I'm not going down. I want to do what I can do to make all my dreams come true. Remember my past, the good and bad, how I made it art even when it was sad. I want to share whatever my gift, and when you're feeling low, I'll give you a lift. I want to live without fear and know that I'm blessed for being here, and know that you're blessed for being here, and know that we're blessed for being here, and know that we're blessed. That's the pledge.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's beautiful, right? I appreciate that. At this time, I want you to give us your final thoughts. What are y'all final thoughts? You know, I can take time to give you your final thoughts.
I want to thank you for having the show, making it available for people to speak about what the issues are, to be able to have some real dialogue about circumstances, things that we need to know. I want to thank you for just having that vision and being a brother who has able to actually. Or actually be the moderator for the conversations that we've had this evening and all the other conversations. And then I noticed in the beginning you were giving information about certain contributions that we've made, certain events that have taken place. And we don't have a school. Maybe there's some schools, I don't know where they are, but when you're teaching children, especially black children, you call them educating them, they need to be educated as to the contributions that they made so they'll feel worthy of being here, and they'll know what their place is, how much they matter in a particular place that they're in. The school system doesn't do that. They refuse to recognize that we're responsible for the light being on. We're responsible for a certain lot of things that are happening. We're responsible for the cell phone. We're responsible for a whole lot of stuff that no one seems to know. We have to find these facts out on our own. And you gave a whole list of events that many black folks have no clue of, no knowledge of. And I'm very grateful for that. I just want to give an applause to you and your organization for at least opening up the door for us to get more knowledge about self and recognition of who we are and the value that we bring to this world.
I appreciate that, Bob. I appreciate that. Yes, sir.
No, I want to echo a lot of what Dune said, actually, just grateful for the platform, your ability to share with your audience. And I want to thank Abiel Dune, Baba Dune, personally, just for his vision and his wisdom and his sacrifice along the way, and also his blessing for us to move this culture forward. Very present in that, very personally grateful, but I'm happy for the culture. Because the culture is made of individuals. Each one of us play a part in the culture, and that defines who we are. Sometimes individuals may often get too far engaged in their individual interests and that, and not always lean more into the culture. And being a last poet has allowed me that voice to add to the broader culture, the bigger culture, and the bigger picture of really counterbalancing this anti-blackness and giving us an ability to articulate that and what we're moving forward. We're going to find justice for Jordan Neely. That will happen. This man will be arrested and be held to account to that. How much I'm almost sure of, I'm positive. And we'll keep doing that work and having these conversations about the you know, the art and the arc of positivity. So I just want to thank really you for having us on this platform and keep doing this work. Keep in the spirit of it. I'm inspired. And I'm really looking forward to writing right when I get off the phone.
Thank you, brother.
Sure, indeed. Thank you. Yeah, I want to thank y'all, brothers, for coming to your platform and sharing that we understand. You know, thank you for the work you did in the past, work you did in the present, work you do in the future, right? Continue to educate the minds of the youth, continue to educate and liberate. If anyone has any close comrades, close behind any of the lines, be looking to Georgia University. If you find on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, for name Georgia University. We also have a website, which is www.georgiauniversity-edu.com. Again, it's www.georgiauniversity-edu.com. You also can contact the email, which is georgejackson71@gmail.com. And also, our founder, who's a current political prisoner, and he has a political prisoner on the West Coast, after he leaves by the cure, has a petition going around right now that you found out, that you found these social media websites. And also, my page on Facebook, one through my secure, another website, this thing called the African Revolutionary National Political Prisoner. We have a petition. You signed a petition to help support the brother movement. That the brother has been a lot of whole 40-plus years. The brother had wrote numerous books. The brother had created this organization that we represent now. Jordan, he created this organization. He created various institutions, put out various pamphlets. You know, the brother just put a lot of work in regards to liberation of the African people behind enemy lines. Some work more than what others have within on the street. You know, so support the brother, you know. I'm saying long live the resistance, long live the guerrilla. Free the land.
Okay, brother, thank you so much. And you be safe.
Thank you, brother.
And stay well. Okay.
Yes,
stay
well. I appreciate that, bro. Peace,
okay.
Peace,
All right, Sharif, we'll hook up later.
Okay, yep.
Sir. Peace.
Okay, all right, man.
Yes, sir.